This is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Over the weekend, thousands of people turned out for the first ever March for Science. It was actually more like 600 marches all over the world. This unprecedented public show of support for science was largely prompted by what many view as the anti-science stances of the Trump administration. But the attempt to organize the science community has also revealed deep divides over the role of science in government and persistent problems when it comes to diversity and inclusion. Later this hour, we'll hear from some who split with the March for Science for just those reasons. We'll also give the Trump administration's science policies a three-month checkup, see how the reality compares to the fears and predictions. But we start with the march itself. Hilary Pilewski is a postdoctoral scholar at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, studying how the ocean absorbs carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. She's also a member of the newly formed group 500 Women Scientists, and she marched here in Falmouth. Hilary, welcome to the show.
Thanks.
And joining us by phone is Andrew Rosenberg. He's director of the Center for Science and Democracy at the Union of Concerned Scientists, which was one of the more than 200 March for Science partner organizations. Andy, always good to talk with you.
Thank you, Heather.
Andy, what do we know so far? Do we have a sense of how many people turned out to these hundreds of marches on Saturday?
Well, it's certainly tens of thousands, but I'm not sure I've seen an accurate count anyplace. What I think is most important, not just the numbers, is that clearly there was energy across the world, really, from Falmouth, Massachusetts, to San Francisco, to Chicago, and then overseas in, London, Berlin, et cetera. I even saw a sign from the North Pole of three scientists who were working at the North Pole who were marching for science.
And I believe I actually heard something about an Antarctic contingent as well, so possibly...
Right.
Both poles involved. Hilary, you marched with about, I think it was about 600 people here in Falmouth. What was that like?
It was really nice to be here in my own community where I knew a lot of the other people at the march and recognized them from people who I see at work and also in other parts of my life. So in some ways, that was very inspiring, even though it was one of the smaller marches.
This is not the first time that federal funding for science has been threatened by any means. And for that matter, science denial is frankly nothing new. It's been around. So what makes now the time that you feel it's really important, and clearly not just you, but hundreds of thousands of people signed onto the Facebook pages and that kind of stuff for the March for Science? What is it about right now that makes it so important to march?
Well, I think it's not necessarily just right now that's feeling important, but that there are a greater number of people than had been aware in the past of the importance of getting outside of our labs and getting outside of just talking to each other as scientists, and the importance now of talking to a broader audience about how the constituency for science is not scientists, it's everyone, because we're really doing this science in the public good. So our goal is to serve everyone in society, and also that we need to include everyone in society in the way we do science.
Andy, the Union for Concerned Scientists has always been a more politically engaged and vocal group. That's kind of the point of the organization. But 200 partner organizations for this march, many of which I think would not have signed on to a political action like this in the past. What do you think is different?
I think actually the scope and scale of the attacks on science are different in the current climate. I think that's both from this administration and Congress, and people are seeing it in other countries. I also think that we're at a time in our culture, including in the science culture, where people are no longer really accepting the argument that, well, we should just retreat to our labs and let this go by. It's not our business. So I think the scale of the attacks are much greater, and it's not just funding. This is actually dismissing scientific information, reversing decisions, undermining the process by which science comes into public policy, and of course attacking scientific information in the public arena and the media and so on. All of that, I think, has people very energized. Again, it's not just in the United States, although here we certainly have our problems.
You say energized. It's certainly that's one contingent of the science community, but there's another large portion of the science community that says, well, it's exactly the fact that science is already becoming so politicized, so polarized, that perhaps we need to not do this. That's also the argument against marching, that this could be too dangerous and really put science into a dangerously polarized place and right into the crosshairs of those who want to try to denigrate science. Do you see that argument?
Well, frankly, I think, you know, of course, scientists like to argue. I don't buy that argument at all. First of all, I think we're already in the crosshairs. I don't think backing away somehow makes us less political. I don't think, for example, you know, the chair of the House Science Committee, Lamar Smith, who has attacked climate science, has gone after particular grants at the NSF and so forth. He's going to be any less political about things if people don't express their opinion. So I don't buy that argument, and I also don't hear it from, you know, earlier career scientists, students, my students and others that I work with. I mean, they feel very strongly that they should speak out. And as, I think it's important for people to recognize that just because you're a scientist, you know, you don't sort of leave your citizenship at the door when you pick up your PhD. You're still a citizen, and you still should speak out. I didn't actually think that the marches were highly partisan. Sure, some people were, but I thought mostly people were saying science is important, and we want to, you know, take our rightful role in our society, in our culture, in our public policy.
I mean, I think there's a subtle distinction there that the marches were definitely, as you say, trying to be not partisan, but definitely political, and that's a distinction that's comfortable for some and not necessarily comfortable for others.
Well, I mean, frankly, the idea that science is political, I'm sorry, that train has already left the station. If people are politicizing science, you can't deal with that fact by simply saying, well, that's not us, we're just going to retreat to our labs and publish papers. I just don't think that works.
In case you're just joining us, my guests are Andrew Rosenberg of the Union for Concerned Scientists and Hilary Pilewski of Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution and 500 Women Scientists. We invite you to join our conversation. Tell us if you marched for science and why or why not. Call us toll-free at 866-999-4626. Send email to livinglabradio@capeandislands.org or find us on Twitter and Facebook. Hilary, you are a climate scientist, and climate science is really front and center in this whole thing. It's perhaps the most dramatic example of where the Trump administration differs from the scientific mainstream. And it's a pressing problem that needs to be addressed in some way politically. This march being on Earth Day, do you think that was the right choice? Or do you think that potentially exacerbates this issue of polarizing or making it more partisan? I mean, for better or for worse, environmentalism and Earth Day have come to be pretty closely associated in many people's mind with a liberal agenda.
I think that's an interesting question. A lot of the challenges that I've heard about the choice to put the science march on Earth Day were actually less about the potential politicization of the science march and the politicization of climate science, where I agree that train has really left the station. Certainly for my entire career as a climate scientist, there has been no choice but to face the fact that the work that I do is seen as political. But I think there were some questions about whether it competed with other events that would naturally have happened on Earth Day as well. But I thought it was a reasonable choice because it was a time that many climate scientists like myself were already thinking about the importance of doing public outreach and communicating the importance of the work that we do to society, which, as Andy said, is increasingly something that we're realizing that we have to do. We can't just be talking amongst ourselves about the importance of climate science.
Andy, there's actually another march next week, the People's Climate March, and the Union of Concerned Scientists is also a partner organization for that march. How much overlap are you seeing both in terms of the goals, the organization of those two marches, and also who might be involved? Is there a concern about this competition, or do you think these two events are perhaps synergistic?
Well, we're sponsoring both because we think they're synergistic. I mean, I do think that the science march this past weekend was very broadly based. I mean, you had, you know, people in biomedical sciences. You actually had physicians marching in Boston, you know, a big contingent from the hospitals and so on. So it wasn't just about climate, and it wasn't so much focused on specific policies. But next weekend in Washington and in other places, but primarily focused on Washington, the People's Climate March, is very directly focused on dealing with the challenges of climate change. And I'd have to say that, you know, I'm not a climate scientist. I work in marine resources, as you know, Heather. But, you know, everyone who works on natural systems sees the effects of climate change. So we all work, in some sense, on climate-related issues now, not just those who model atmosphere and oceans and climate processes themselves. And so I think it is very broadly based in the science community anyway, even though it's focused on climate. And very specifically, the People's Climate March is calling for and being led by groups that are working for justice and equity, addressing issues of environmental justice and addressing issues of equity in our society, because, of course, vulnerable communities, disadvantaged communities, communities of color are really on the front lines of climate change all around the world. They are usually the most vulnerable to the ongoing effects. So that is front and center in the People's Climate March in a different way than in the March for Science.
Well, the March for Science has actually taken a lot of criticism, particularly on social media, for sidelining issues of diversity and inclusion,
right.
Excluding particularly women of color who wanted to help and advise on the march, and they've really been criticized for not being responsive enough to those requests, to those criticisms from underrepresented minorities. From the kind of organizer or partner organization standpoint, do you see that difference, and how do you feel about some of those critiques? And I mean, given that you are also part of the People's Climate March, where, as you said, equity and social justice is such a key issue, does that feel uncomfortable at all when you're in the March for Science setting?
Well, we raised the issues of diversity and inclusion with the organizers of the March for Science. I mean, understand that the organization of the March for Science was very much grassroots and frankly, you know, really was not experienced in developing this kind of an event. And so they learned along the way, as we all do. And I think they tried to respond effectively and include many more communities of color, bring in the Hip Hop Caucus and others. I know some of the scientists who are working with the organization who were trying to address those issues, not to the satisfaction of some, and I understand that, and I think it was a little bit, again, learning on the job, but I don't think the intention was to be exclusive. I do think it was useful, actually, to highlight some of the issues within the science community, which people don't like to talk about, of diversity and inclusion. And so it was important to do that and have that conversation apart from the march itself. And so the people who stood aside, they're raising important points.
Hillary, you're a member of this group, 500 Women Scientists, which kind of came together shortly after the election. And diversity and inclusion is front and center. I mean, there's kind of a pledge of action points, and many of them have to do with diversity and inclusion. Did the critiques of the march ring true for you, and did they make you question whether or not you wanted to take part?
Yes, absolutely. So I really did a lot of soul searching about how to respond to those critiques that were raised, particularly by women of color. And one of the reasons that I was so excited about this March for Science at the beginning was that their initial platform really highlighted the importance of diversity, and they formed this diversity team and brought in many people who are much more experienced with talking about the issues of diversity and inclusion in science, who have been doing this work for a long time, who aren't new to this, and the way many white people and white women like myself are much newer to doing this kind of work. And so I think it's really important to be listening to the voices of the most marginalized people in the scientific community when we talk about how we stand up for science, because I think in a lot of ways, the organization of the March for Science reproduced a lot of the same issues that have been longstanding in the scientific community, that we are listening to voices of people who are more privileged, who tend to be the people who are asking, should we march in the first place? And we were less responsive to the voices of people who were talking about the importance of centering diversity and inclusion.
We are going to hear more of those voices from people of color who chose not to participate in the march coming up later this hour. That's Hillary Pilevsky. She's a postdoctoral scholar at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution and a member of 500 Women Scientists. We also spoke with Andrew Rosenberg of the Union for Concerned Scientists Center for Science and Democracy. Thank you so much to both of you.
Thank you, Heather.
Thank you.
I'm Heather Goldstone. We want to hear from you. Did you march for science? Why or why not? Call us toll-free at 866-999-4626. You can email us at livinglabradio@capeandislands.org. You can also find us on Twitter and Facebook. We're Living Lab Radio. More when the show continues after a short break. This is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Not everyone embraced the March for Science. We're going to hear now from a few who made conscious choices not to march, and not because they don't support science. First up is Erin Labreck. She's a Florida-based marine ecologist who frequently collaborates with scientists here on Cape Cod. She spoke with WCAI's Alicia Orsini about her reservations.
I think it was the end of January I first heard about the March for Science on social media platforms. I think it was Facebook or something like that. And my gut reaction, my initial reaction was, oh, this is a really bad idea. Because especially coming after the Women's March, there's such a, the inauguration and then the Women's March, there's been such a divide in the country. And I just felt like this March for Science, it was trying to recreate something the Women's March was doing, but by doing that, it would make the divide bigger. It wouldn't close the divide. And I didn't see that as a productive way to move forward, to move science forward, really. Because so much, I think, of the problem that we have with the mistrust of science is that people don't understand it.
So where in your mind does politics get to cross with science? What kind of things do you think are effective?
Well, I think science should definitely inform policy making. Everything that we do, that we experience in every moment of our lives has to do with science. The houses that we live in, the food that we eat, the cars that we drive, you know, it all comes from science. And so there is definitely a place for science. How it goes into politics, I don't think science should be political. I think it has become political. But I think most scientists, if you talk to them, can separate their values, their politics, from the science that they do. You're trained as a scientist, you go out and you study and you observe and you do experiments. When you're talking about how how science should influence policy, maybe influence isn't the right word, inform policy, you're giving policymakers information to make better decisions. That's what science is about. It's not about telling people what is right or wrong.
What are your hopes for, after having conversations with people who are organizing and marching, what are your hopes will come out of the march itself?
I've seen it. So I've actually been following a bunch of the marches on stuff on social media, and there seems to be a really wonderful, positive message, just celebrating science that is coming out. That I'm excited about. What I really hope is that message can cross the divide that we have in the country right now, and we can get people who are not interested in science or distrust it to listen, and maybe we can listen to them. But I think most important, what I would love to see come out of this is scientists interacting more in their communities, having scientists get out in the community and just talk with, Joe Schmo on the street and see what's going on. I think that'll do a lot to help move us forward. And the third thing that I would love to see come out of this is getting more kids really inspired about the sciences. Teaching them about the world that we live in and what science is about, I think is critical, and it's something that we really need to put more support and more funding into.
That was marine ecologist Erin Labreck speaking with WCAI's Alicia Orsini. Do you agree? Do you think the march was the right idea or the wrong way to support science? Tell us your thoughts. Our phone number is 866-999-4626. Our email address is livinglabradio@capeandislands.org. We're also on Twitter and Facebook. Now, joining me by phone are two people who were also most definitely not at the March for Science. And it wasn't because they thought it was too political. They've been vocal in their criticism of the march for the way organizers handled issues of diversity and inclusion, and in particular, how they treated women of color. Calif Wilson is a researcher at the biopharmaceutical company Cellectis. He tweets as "Hey, Dr. Wilson." And Zalika Zavalos is an applied sociologist with Swinburne University in Melbourne, Australia. She tweets as "Other Sociologist." Welcome to both of you.
Thank you for having us.
Calif, can you just share the story of your first interaction for the March for Science and how you were received when you offered to help with the march?
Yeah, I filled out the forms online to participate, and I created a few Twitter threads about how to engage policymakers. And effectively, those overtures were ignored, no responses. I reached out to specific people who were a part of planning the local march in New York City as well as the D.C. march, and I think it took a while, maybe deep into February, and I started deep into March before I started getting any responses.
Were you surprised by that?
Absolutely. One of the reasons is that I, from having done science policy work, outreach, science communication, I knew that there are a lot of scientists who aren't necessarily working outside of the laboratories in those areas. And for someone like me who've had that experience, to make that experience available and being willing to be open with it, it was a bit surprising that it wasn't accepted or received.
Zalika, what about you? What was your personal experience with the March for Science?
Well, I guess it was similar in that because they were doing a lot of their calls for people to volunteer and doing a lot of their promotions on Twitter and other social media, I started to interact with those posts, particularly on Twitter, and in particular providing advice, so resources to studies on diversity, also giving them advice about the types of things they should be thinking about, like accessibility, equity and inclusion. And also I was in conversations with some members of the committee for the Central Organising Committee in the DC March, as well as some of the local marches here in Australia.
At what point did you start to feel that the responses you were getting were something other than simply the result of perhaps disorganization or overwhelm on the part of the organizers and feel that you really needed to step away from the march and do something different?
I guess it became apparent pretty quickly because a lot of the communications that were coming out from the Central March were very problematic. So even they were set up on Twitter around the 24th of January, and by the 26th of January, there had been so many errors consistently, particularly with communications promoting stereotypical ideas about science, particularly, you know, white men's achievements in science. So that became quite apparent. And there were, we're talking hundreds of scientists around the world who were engaging with those social media person providing a lot of feedback about why that approach was damaging. And so that went on for weeks. And then I guess there was just one too many problems happening. It was almost as if there was some major problem with their diversity communications at least weekly. Sometimes things were happening, you know, twice in a row where they were reproducing some very infamous problems of sexism. There were some really damaging communications that were had overtures of racism by.
Can you give us an example of that?
Sure. So one of the, I'll give you a couple. So one that was that began with Los Angeles was they tweeted in early February that they had been hearing from scientists that there might be problems in connection with having a focus on diversity that might lead to violence. And so they sort of asked their followers, what are you going to do to keep the protest free from violence or peaceful? And that's actually quite a dangerous historical connection that they're making from having minorities attend a a science event to it leading to violence. There's actually no correlation between the two, other than policing is obviously quite different when there are minorities rather than majority white people. So that's quite exclusionary. And then around a month later, the DC march had already done a number of problematic things from, for example, not engaging with black scientists at all or having to issue a number of personalised apologies to individual black scientists for not listening to their critiques. And then they actually appropriated some African-American vernacular in one of their communications. And having had minority scientists, particularly black scientists, been ignored for, at that stage, it was over 2 months now, and then using AVE to try and promote the march was in very poor taste and quite racist.
You have actually, as a sociologist, analyzed responses to at least one of the statements. March organizers have revised their diversity statements and policies a number of times, but analyzed responses on social media to one of those statements. What did you find the broader responses were to this?
Yes, so they, as you mentioned, they had put out a number of statements that were basically responding to the critiques, both from minority scientists, and then they actually scaled back their diversity statement after a very high-profile white male scientist critiqued their diversity statement. So then they released their third one, which was in place for the longest. And having a look at the responses from their supporters, I found that the most vocal responses to the diversity statement really focused on discouraging a focus on diversity. So the responses said things like, you know, diversity will politicize the march, it'll politicize science, let's focus on the facts. They talked about how diversity divides the scientific community and that it takes away or depreciates the inherent value that they see in science. So people thinking that science is already equal and not recognizing the fact that there are a lot of structural inequalities embedded within scientific practices and policies. And there were a number of people who also thought that having a focus on diversity would be distracting from the goals of the march. And, of course, these responses are really about a fear of being inclusive of what underrepresented minority scientists can bring to science and being not having an exposure to the achievements as well as the issues and challenges that minorities face in science.
Calif, you have started a Twitter hashtag AltSciMarch, and both you and Zalika have been very active on another hashtag started by biologist Stephanie Page, which is MarginSci. What is, in your mind, the goal of these Twitter hashtags, these conversations or groups that they create in terms of pushing forward an agenda of diversity and inclusion in science?
Well, what we find is that, as Zalika was pointing out, is that there's the resistance to understanding that equity, diversity, and inclusion can be had amongst any other conversation. It's not separate. It's both and. And so one of the things that the hashtags were able to do is allow people to have those conversations and in a way that it could be visible. We could see each other having these conversations, as well as we could point the March for Science to those conversations.
I spoke with both a group of Latina women and an African-American mother and son at the march in D.C. that I was covering this weekend. And in both cases, they were obviously aware that there is a diversity problem in science, that we need to foster greater diversity within the scientific community. But they hadn't necessarily heard about the specific problems with the march that you're talking about. Since a lot of this back and forth has been happening on social media, do you think that limits how far this conversation has reached into the community?
I don't necessarily think it's a limitation. What the difference is that just in general, the question is, how much is the general public actually connected to scientists, and how much is the general public actually aware of some of these other things that are going on. So unless someone was tuned into those hashtags or to specific scientists from marginalized communities, they may not necessarily be aware of it.
I mean, that's kind of a preaching to the choir problem, right? If you're not already tuned into this issue, you may not have heard that there was an issue to think about here with the march.
Potentially, that's the case. However, I just look at it as an amplifying thing, right? So if we were actually taking the approach of trying to have a public campaign to connect with the general public and say, you know, these particular issues related to equity, diversity, and inclusion are problematic within the Science March. If that was a larger push in a larger organization, then that may have happened. But at the same time, I wonder if for those, the people that you talked to at the march, did you also ask them, what is your perception of the scientists that are there and what do those scientists look like? And what is, and before coming to this march, what do you think scientists look like or who scientists were? And has that changed?
I guess I didn't ask those specific questions, but I can tell you that I heard at least a couple of marchers as we were on the, you know, on the actual march route commenting that this was one of the whitest crowds they had ever seen. And I think that's a pretty fair characterization of the march, at least in D.C. This discourse that's been going on around the march, the perhaps broader awareness that has come about in the context of the march specifically, Zalika, do you see an opportunity for positive changes more broadly in the science community to come out of this?
I do think that there's a positive momentum in the fact that these conversations have been happening for a very long time. Underrepresented minority scientists have been doing activism for decades and have always been activists. But I guess this the hashtags in particular allowed these conversations to converge and from different networks from different parts of the world to join their voices together. I think that's a big positive. And although we were, I guess many of us were dismayed that the central organizing committee weren't able to adequately respond to the feedback and the resources and the advice that we were giving them, you can see that we did have an effect because at the beginning they hadn't even thought about diversity. The diversity statements are a direct result of that activism that was happening, those conversations that were happening over social media. And so now there's this, I guess, this conversation that has been happening in science in connection to the march is also, it's a microcosm of science in general. We have a problem in many parts of the world where equity, diversity, inclusion, it's been a long-standing issue. And the march has just brought this to the surface. And the positive thing now is that we can compare and contrast and bring those different experiences from different parts of the world and think about how we might respond to campaigns like the Science March and hopefully continue to have an effect by working together.
Zalika Zavalos is a sociologist with Swinburne University in Melbourne, Australia. Calif Wilson is a biomedical researcher and the digital media manager for the National Science and Technology News Service. Thank you so much to both of you.
Thank you.
We also want to hear your thoughts on the March for Science. Amy from Ohio emails, I'm a science writer, journalist, and information officer, and a woman of color. 100% of my day is spent in defense of science, but I believe the March for Science was a failure on many fronts, primarily by distracting from Earth Day, by preaching to the choir, and failing to target a single objective. Given the current political climate, we need to reach out to Trump supporters. The term science scares people off. They don't understand it. If the goal was to persuade in governmental policy, it's best to do that in terms of research that can fuel the economy, like solar power or vaccine research that can stave off costly disease. And we asked for your thoughts. Barbara is on the line from Oak Bluffs. Barbara, did you march this weekend?
Yeah, hi. I wasn't at the march. I was participating in the 25th annual beach cleanup on Martha's Vineyard, which occurred on the same day. And I just wanted to say that this is the 25th annual one, and the event is really hyper-successful because it has three components. We have the beach cleanup from 10 to noon, and then our local marquee hotel here, the Harborview Hotel, gives us a meeting room to have a luncheon, a big, fantastic meal, and all the vineyard cooks and everybody brings their food. And then after this meal, we had a lecture from two scientists from Watal talking about their studies on the plastics in the ocean problem and a really good slide talk. And so I just wanted to put out about that model, and I would love it, Heather, if you did a show on the Vineyard Conservation Society and the beach cleanup in particular, because, you know, just communicating the model to other people on the Cape and around the area would be great because it really works.
So we will take that under advisement. Barbara, thank you so much for your call. I'm Heather Goldstone. Living Lab continues with a three-month checkup for the Trump administration's science policies after a short break. Welcome back to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. As soon as President Trump was elected, even before he took office, the science community went on red alert. There's the unprecedented March for Science, which we've been talking about. Also efforts to back up government-held data against possible deletion. So now, 3 months into Donald Trump's presidency, we're asking if the reality has lived up to the fears and predictions. On his way out of D.C., President Obama's top science advisor vowed to keep an eye on the Trump administration. John Holdren has returned to his posts at Woods Hole Research Center and Harvard University, and he joins me now in our Woods Hole studio. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks. Good to be here.
And with us by phone is John Dupuy. He's a science librarian at Stacey Science and Engineering Library at York University in Toronto, and he's author of the Confessions of a Science Librarian blog, where he chronicled the anti-science policies of former Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper, and he has endeavored to do the same for President Trump. John, good to have you back on the show.
Good to be here.
Great to be here.
Okay, so John and John, did either of you march over the weekend? I know, John Holdren, you were in D.C., then in Boston, then here in Falmouth, a busy weekend, right?
Right. I did some pre-march events in Washington, D.C., and then flew back to Boston to march with my wife on the Boston Common.
And John Dupuy, Canadian scientists have been expressing solidarity with American scientists over the past few months. Any march action where you were?
Well, there was about 15 or 16 marches all across Canada, including one here in Toronto, where we had about 3,000 people, which was, I think, is actually a pretty good turnout for that kind of a thing. And I was lucky enough that they asked me to speak at the march. So I marched and rallied the crowd, and I think it was a pretty positive atmosphere. People, I think, saw that there's a lot of work ahead of them, and there seemed to be a lot of enthusiasm about getting down to work.
Now, John Dupuy, in terms of tracking what has been going on with the Trump administration, the pace of things has been pretty dizzying. How have you been trying to keep track of what's going on?
Well, I think initially what I thought I would do was maybe try and put up some sort of post every month or so. But the dizzying pace has made it really hard for me to kind of keep track. And, I mean, I compare to, you know, compared to what happened here in Canada under the Harper regime, I think, was just as anti-science as the Trump regime in a lot of ways. But they were a little shy about it. They liked to pretend to be pro-science. And so they were trying to be fairly stealthy. They would hide things in massive budget bills and that sort of thing. So it was a drip, drip, drip for most of the time. And for me, the Trump era has been a fire hose. So it has been. It's a lot. You know, it is a lot more work in one sense because there's a lot more. In another sense, it's less work because in the Harper regime, I had to go look for stuff. And let's just say it hasn't been such hard work for me to find stuff about Trump and science. It's just flying in left, right, and center.
John Holdren, if you had to pick from the fire hose of science policies and stances coming from the Trump administration, is there one thing to date that you could say worries you most?
Well, it really is hard to pick. I think one of the big worries is the budget proposals that emanated from the White House last month. While it's important to understand that those are only proposals and that the Congress ultimately will determine the budgets. If anything like the Trump proposals were accepted by the Congress, it would be an enormous setback for science. Included are really astonishingly enough, big cuts at the National Institutes of Health, which ordinarily have enjoyed bipartisan support in the U.S. government. After all, they're addressing diseases, cancer, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, diabetes, that affect just about everybody's family or friends one way or the other. Big cuts at the Environmental Protection Agency, a 31% cut proposed overall, a 50% cut in R&D at the Environmental Protection Agency, eliminating entirely the budget for the Advanced Research Projects Agency for Energy, cutting another $2 billion from clean and efficient energy research, cutting $900 million from the Department of Energy's Office of Science. I mean, these are draconian cuts and would be enormous setbacks for U.S. leadership in both basic and applied science. So you might say that's the biggest worry, although what the Trump administration is doing explicitly in the domain of climate policy is certainly a close second.
Let's go back to the budget issue. As you said, those are proposed numbers. This is in Congress's hands. But we've seen Congress, not just in the past few months, really over the course of 10 or 20 years, moving in a direction that's less and less friendly toward government funding of science. How realistic do you think those proposals are? How likely are they to be approved by Congress?
Well, it's a complicated situation. For one thing, the overall Trump budget priorities, namely big increase in defense spending, big increase in infrastructure, no changes to Social Security or Medicare, reduce the deficit, those prescriptions, those overarching prescriptions, if they were accepted by Congress, would leave no choice but to drastically cut every other component of discretionary spending besides defense and infrastructure. So irrespective of legitimate concerns about trends in Congress toward basically less support for basic research and a lack of interest, certainly, in support for research on clean and efficient energy and on climate change, we could be in the soup again if the overall budget priorities of the Trump administration are accepted by Congress. But certainly you're right, particularly about basic research. There has been a tendency among particularly Republicans in Congress to question whether the federal government should be funding basic research at all. The notion being the government should only fund research whose outcomes can be identified in advance as beneficial to the economy or public health or national security. And of course, it is the nature of basic research that you cannot specify the outcomes in advance. And yet we know from history that basic research provides the seed corn from which future extremely valuable applied advances come.
John Dupuy, we talked a couple of months ago about fears in the science community that we could see government-held data, databases, reports disappearing, if not deleted, at least public access withheld from those. I did see one op-ed in The Guardian a few weeks ago, an Arctic researcher claiming that the Trump administration is deleting research papers and reports, at least their access online. Have you seen evidence that those kinds of fears of the science community are being realized?
Well, not yet, at least not so explicitly. So I think what has happened is there's a lot of cases where things might have been missing for a long time, but people are only just noticing and pointing it out. From the librarian's perspective, government websites are amongst the most notorious for losing things. You know, every time you get a new webmaster, they change something. Every time there's a new whatever, something gets changed. So that stuff is hard to tell. It's just really hard to tell. And I think for that, we may see the story play out over one or two more years. What really worries me is something that I saw last week, the shuttering of the EPA's open data web service. That's the kind of thing that's that for me is very worrying, because one of the biggest trends in government over the last 5 years is open data, is open government data. And that's hugely important because it allows the public to see what's happening within government. It allows the public to see what, you know, the state of their own environment. And so this open data web service is set to be shuttered this Friday. And for me, that's the kind of thing that's extremely worrying, because that affects our ability to do science moving forward with the kind of data that's created within the EPA.
If I can just jump in on top of that very cogent comment by John, the other big problem with data is ceasing the collection of important data going forward. So it's one very bad thing to shut down public access to data that have already been collected. It's, in a way, even worse to cease the collection of data, something that can never be reversed, in the sense that data not collected about what's going on in our environment now, about what's going on in weather and climate, what's going on in the hydrologic cycle. Under the budget proposals released by the White House last month, major Earth observation programs in NASA would be drastically cut back. Specific missions that are crucial to measuring what's happening with greenhouse gases, for example, what's happening with the ice in Antarctica and Greenland. If those crucial missions are cut back, as Trump has proposed, we will have a gap of whatever duration in our historical data records of what is going on in the environment. And that, again, cannot be undone.
John Holdren, one thing that you have highlighted as a major concern is the lack of scientists in advisory roles in the Trump administration. To my knowledge, anyway, your position still has yet to be filled, that of science advisor to the president and director of the Office of Science and Technology Policy. Is that
is correct. One can hope that the Trump administration will yet appoint a director of the Office of Science and Technology Policy in the White House. Will make that person an assistant to the president for science and technology, so the person has direct access to President Trump. One can hope, but it hasn't happened yet. President Obama nominated me to those positions on December 20th, 2008, a month before inauguration. We're now nearly 100 days after inauguration, and President Trump has not appointed anybody. I recently wrote an op-ed piece about why we need science advice in the White House. There are some folks close to Trump who have suggested that we don't need to fill these positions, that there's no need to have advice about science and technology in the White House. I think that would be an extremely perverse result if that's where it ended up. But it's not just in the White House. There is no NOAA administrator, no administrator of NASA, no Department of Energy chief scientist, no director of the U.S. Geological Survey, no director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Most of the undersecretary and assistant secretary positions across the cabinet departments that deal with science and technology are still vacant. So there is a much larger scale pattern of failure to fill these positions. And indeed, in fairness, I have to say it's not just the science and technology positions. A lot of other positions are also unfilled. And there's real question as to whether the Trump White House has figured out that you actually need people in these positions to do the work of government properly.
Well, we will have to continue keeping an eye on this. John Holdren was President Obama's top science advisor. He currently holds multiple positions at Harvard University and Woods Hole Research Center. John Dupuy is science librarian at Stacy Science and Engineering Library at York University and author of the Confessions of a Science Librarian blog. Thanks to both of you.
It was great to be with you.
We're always looking for your science stories and what you find curious or confusing about the news you see and hear elsewhere. You can email us, livinglabradio@capeandislands.org. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter. Until next week, this is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab is produced by Heather Goldstone and Elsa Partan. Mindy Todd is the executive producer. Major support for Living Lab comes from the Candida Fund, furthering the values that contribute to a healthy planet.